children's pastor here and communications pastor, and I am also a grateful recovering alcoholic. I had very little to do with it. Yes, I am. I have been given a wonderful, wonderful gift, the gift of willingness to stay sober one more day, 24 hours at a time. And that is because that I have tapped into a power greater than myself. I've tapped into the God of kindness and mercy and power and justice and mercy. And that's where I get my strength to do that. I, of course, am not grateful that I'm an alcoholic. As my friend Beverly says, that would be ridiculous. That would be ridiculous. I am just grateful that I know what is wrong with me. I'm so grateful. And there are many other people out there that are grateful also. There are whole cities that are glad that I don't drink anymore. And if you don't believe me, you just need to try to cross the Denver, Colorado border with me. Just try. They have a sign up. But that doesn't, because I've been given this gift, it does not mean that I don't have to participate. It doesn't mean I don't have to do my part. And I cannot take this gift for granted. My life is run differently than many of yours. I don't have some of the luxuries, if you will, that some of you have, like friendship with alcohol. But I don't have to be an expert. God is. And that's what I'm here to talk to you about this morning. I was here a year and a half ago and talked to you guys about this, shared my experience, strength, and hope about it, and about my addiction and my recovery that is going on 13 years. I wanted to tell you guys a little bit of what happened, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, and to bring a greater understanding to those of you that are not alcoholics and addicts of what it feels like to be caught in this debilitating disease. And I do believe it's a disease. And why it's so difficult to recover, how many different things are involved in recovery that have to be tackled on all fronts. And then next week, I'm going to speak to the families of addicts and alcoholics. I know this is an issue for many of you. I've talked to many of you, and I want to sort of help bring some clarity out of the confusion, learn how to love the alcoholic, maybe lead with mercy without killing the alcoholic. And I do believe that is possible to do. And so last year, when I was here, I talked a little bit about my BFF, my best friend, Sky, that hung around with me, that I met when I was a teenager. It is a love story of epic proportions. It is a story of a friendship that really, really went bad. From when I was a teenager and I came face to face with alcohol for the first time, it was love at first sight. Man, I was home. I loved it. You know why I loved it? Because it helped me to do everything that I did not feel like I can do. I had all this teenage angst, and I had was kind of a depressed kid, and it helped me be brave and funny and silly and bold and smarter and cool, and it helped me to get past the pain, and I had some depression, and it just was a panacea, man. It helped me assuage all of that. My teenage angst kind of disappeared. I was the kind of kid, and many of you alcoholics and addicts will know this, I was never really comfortable in my own skin. And so alcohol, it just made me be me, only better. It was Jill with sparkles all over. And there was no moment so good that alcohol couldn't make better, and there was no moment so bad that alcohol couldn't make better. Man, and as what happens with some teenage friendships, it kept growing and growing and becoming more and more obsessive. You know, we're BFFs, and pretty soon we were pretty much inseparable. We spent more time together and edged everything else out. It was always there. And it started following me and lurking in the shadows, and it was always, always behind me. On the outside, I looked kind of normal. But if you look closely, you will definitely see alcohol in the picture somewhere. At any school activity, my 16th birthday party, prom, graduation, all of those, somewhere in there, alcohol was lurking back there. My friends kind of started complaining. They were like, why do you got to be around alcohol? Why do you got to bring alcohol around all the time? Because they knew that it was selfishly edging out everything else in my, I can see the pictures just came out because no one's looking at me anymore. And it was my constant companion. Now, here's this weird thing that happened to me, okay? When I got married, I got married pretty young. And for some reason, and I don't understand why, and this happens to people sometimes, but I got this reprieve from my alcoholism. And I don't know why. Maybe it's because I was busy. Maybe it's because I was accountable. Maybe it's because I was deliriously happy with these two beautiful daughters I had. I'm not sure what it was, but I thought it had left me. But in reality, that was kind of a big mistake on my part, because it was at the gym doing push-ups waiting for me to get out of there, waiting till I wasn't so busy and accountable and happy. And oh my goodness, did that day come. I went through a really painful divorce. Any of you that heard me speak last time, I talked a little bit about that. And that pain, coupled with my genetics, which predisposed me to alcoholism, I was off to the races. It moved like a freight train through my life. And pretty soon, I was confronted with family and friends and boyfriends and coworkers, and they weren't so whiny anymore. They were more demanding, and they would say things to me like, where they used to say things like, "You're so funny," now they said, "You're an embarrassment." When they used to say, "You are the life of the party," now they said, "You ruin everyone's good time." And when they used to say to me, "You are so brave," now they said, "You are reckless." And it was not so fun anymore. And I started looking at myself in the mirror in the morning going, "I hate you, I hate you, I hate you, I hate you, I hate you." And I really wanted to stop. I really did. I went through all kinds of things to try to stop, man, on my own. I tried geographical changes. I moved to the mountains. I took up goat farming for a while. I changed jobs. I changed everything about me. And every job I had, and every place I moved, and everything I did, alcohol was there. It always found me. And I took so much flack for my drinking that I started living this secret double life. And that's our brilliant solution. You know, if people complain too much, just do it by yourself. And that's what I did. But I knew very soon that I was going to have to stop, or I was going to die. Because I was going to kill somebody, or someone was going to kill me. Definitely. There's this wonderful scene, painful but wonderful scene, that I think captures the way that we feel as Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's from 28 Days. And Ed Sandra Bullock is dancing at her sister's wedding, and she's twirling and having this wonderful time, and she flings herself off, oh, right over the buffet table and right over the wedding cake. And there's this moment on her face, which I can so identify with, where all of a sudden it's like, "Oh dear, this is not funny or fun anymore." My moment like that came at my parents' 50th wedding anniversary. I was an event planner, and I'll tell you, that party was fabulous. It was decorated to the nines. We had brought in all my parents' friends from out of town and their church friends, and it was really, really attractive. And then I promptly got completely wasted. And I fell over the buffet table. And when I woke up, they were cleaning up around me, and all my family was gone. Now, all of a sudden, it wasn't so fun anymore. And so here's the thing. I would have these awful things happen, and then I'd wake up the next morning, and I would gird up my loins, so to speak, and I would get strong, and I would think, never again, never, never, never. I am not going to do this anymore. I am strong enough to do this. I can do this. I got it. Okay, deep breath. You're not going to do this anymore. You are going to survive without alcohol. You're a brave woman. You've done brave things before. You've encountered so much and been triumphant, And every time I tried, this is what happened. Yes, I know that seems ridiculous, and I know it's funny, but I'm telling you, if you're an alcoholic and addict, you know how that feels. You have the best intentions, and bam, it's right there. And oh, the defeat. But I really, really, really did want to quit. But this is the best way to make you understand what it feels like to be enslaved. This friendship, this love affair, if you will, that you cannot walk away from. You just can't seem to leave. The definite, what causes it really, I can tell you, nobody knows with 100% certainty. And I read everything I can about this. And of course, I sit in lots of meetings and hear people talk about it. But nobody knows with 100% certainty. But I'll tell you what we do know with 100% certainty. We know somebody who suffers from it. Every single one of us knows somebody or knows somebody who knows somebody. There is not that many degrees of separation between us and an alcoholic or addict. And so on your insert, where I've written all these beautiful notes for you to follow along with, and your insert in there, I would love for you guys to just take 1 minute and to think about somebody that you know that suffers from this or that you think may suffer from it. And I want you to just write their name down there. I'm just gonna shut up here for a minute so you can do that. And you can use initials or you can use a code name. It doesn't matter. The definition of alcoholism and addiction, and I'm going to use those two terms interchangeably here this morning. So if I say alcoholism, you'll know that it could mean addiction too and vice versa. Alcoholism is a disabling disorder characterized by compulsive and uncontrolled substance abuse, despite, at the very least, adverse effects upon one's health and negative social consequences. We alcoholics believe that we are people who have both feet firmly planted right in thin air. We participate in insane and reckless behavior. We believe that we are slaveries to our addiction, and we believe that we have a disease of the mind, body, and spirit. There's this battle that happens for us and inside of us. We are at war with ourselves. We are at war with our insides. We are at war with our God. We're at war with everybody. But especially with this disease that seems to just enslave us. Nobody wants it. Nobody sets out to say, okay, I'm a teenager and I'm going to become an alcoholic. Bring it on. That doesn't happen. What we really want is to be comfortable in our own skin, and we want to have a good time. But you put our genetics and those life events, and we're off. Paul, in the book of Romans, I love this verse because he is very, very well acquainted with our battle, with battling things that, and the conflict that happens inside of us. I'm going to be reading from the Message this morning, so if any of you guys go, I don't recognize that from the Bible. It is. Okay? I'm full of myself. I've spent a long time in sin's prison. What I don't understand about myself is that I decide one way and then I act another, doing things I absolutely despise. The power of sin within me keeps sabotaging my best intentions. I obviously need help. I realize that I don't have what it takes. I can will it, but I can't do it. I decide not to do bad and then I do it anyway. My decisions, such as they are, don't result in actions. Something has gone terribly wrong deep within me and gets the better of me every time. I've tried everything and nothing helps. I'm at the end of my rope. Is there no one who can do anything for me? Isn't that the real question? The answer, thank God, is that Jesus Christ can and does. He acted to set things right in this life of contradictions, where I want to serve God with all my heart and mind, but am pulled by the influence of sin to do something totally different. Can you hear his desperation? I certainly can. And I understand his desperation. It is far, far more complex than just a physical addiction. And left untreated, it will totally progress. We don't grow out of it. A true alcoholic ends up in jail, sober, or dead. And the best research out there, most people agree that it's about 50% genetics and 50% environment. 50% genetics. We know that there's heightened risk factors from having family members who struggle with addiction, and how this can predispose us to alcoholism and can be triggered by life events. And the other 50%, life events, environment, family dynamics, culture, and other experiential factors. So in the end, really, though, I mean, it's not all that important what causes it. I mean, when you get right down to it, whatever we believe, it's not my fault. I know it's not my fault, but it is most definitely my responsibility. And I have to take responsibility for my recovery. So here's some of the symptoms of it, and I'm going to go through like this, some of the symptoms and the signs and the steps that you kind of go through to get well. But here's some of the symptoms, and I love Proverbs, that wonderful book in the Bible that tells us so many cool things, but I love this verse because it tells us about the alcoholic. It says, who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has strife? Who has complaints? Me. Who has needless bruises? Who has bloodshot eyes? Those who linger over wine and who go to sample bowls of mixed wine. Do not gaze at wine when it is red and when it sparkles in the cup, when it goes down smoothly. In the end, it bites like a snake and poisons like a viper. Your eyes will see strange sights. Your mind will imagine confusing things. You will be like one sleeping on the high seas, lying on top of the rigging. They hit me, you say, but I'm not hurt. They beat me, but I don't feel it. When can I wake up so I can find another drink? That is our craziness. We know that we have a disease that is cunning, baffling, and powerful, and without help, it is too much for us. We need superhuman strength and power. Otherwise, it is impossible for us to live whole lives, the lives that God intends for us to live. It is complicated sometimes and very simple other times. But there is one who understands it all and knows how to unravel it, and that one is God. Proverbs, if as you listen to that, you probably saw some of the signs of an alcoholic, and this is just my list. These are just some of the things that I look for, but it's kind of a compilation of a lot of different places. The first thing that we kind of see is this romanticizing of alcohol. You know, you could hear it in that verse from Proverbs, that sparkly and smooth and bubbly and Jill with sparkles in the cup. You know, I mean, it's just, we tend to forget being on the floor in our own vomit with people sweeping up around us. Like, we romanticize it. We have an obsession. Obsession that really kind of transcends any consequences that we have. We've come to believe a lie that this time it will be different. It's the great obsession with all of us, that this time it'll be different. This time I'll be able to drink and it'll be different. We want to be able to drink like normal people. To understand this obsession, I want to tell you guys a story that I heard a long time ago. When I first entered sobriety, and it's about this old man told, his name was Joe, and he told about this time that they lived out in the country. He was like 70 when I heard him speak, and so this happened when he was like 5, so it was like 65 years before. And he said they lived out in the country, and he had 6 brothers and sisters, and on Saturday night, the mother would pull the tub up next to this coal stove and she'd fill it full of hot water, and the kids would start taking baths from the oldest to the youngest. And so he was the youngest, and he goes, obviously by the time it got to me, it was pretty scummy. And he said, one day I got in there and I reached down to pick up soap and burned my rear end on that stove. And he said, you know, that thing hurt. He said, it put a blister about the size of my hand on my rear end. And he said, it split in the cold. Every time he'd sit down, it would split open. It hurt. Every time he got paddled, it hurt. Yeah, it was a mess. And he said, I want you all to know that in 65 years, I have never one time ever romanticized about what it would be like to drop my drawers and put my rear on a hot stove. Not once. He said, however, alcohol burned my rear end. I lost my children and my wife, my parents and my job, money, pride, self-esteem. I lost God. And all the time, alcoholism was going, it won't burn you this time. This time it'll be different. That, my friends, is an obsession of the mind. And that's what we have as alcoholics. We have increased tolerance. Personality changes. One drink is not enough and 1,000 is too many. That's right. One drink is too many, 1,000 isn't enough. My friends are going, you got it wrong, Jill. That's good. Okay, but you know what I mean, okay? We have a personality change when we drink. We become other people. And of course, I've never met an alcoholic that didn't deny they were at first. They're always like, what? What? Not me. You know, mind your own business. And there was always blaming, always excuses at first. And of course, one of these great markers is blackouts. The first time I put alcohol in my body when I was a teenager, I blacked out. The first time. And that is one of the markers. And this is my own personal opinion. You know, I meet people all the time that are new to recovery, and they seem to have this great sense of injustice about them. Like, God has abandoned them at some crucial point in their life. They feel like their prayers kind of bounce off the ceiling. They feel that at this important time in their life, sometime they have been left alone and left to deal with things. They kind of question God's mercy and justice and who is responsible for dispensing the mercy and justice. And it certainly can't be him because he is not fair. And many of them have had really, really bad lives, and they have every reason in the world to question the dispensing of mercy and justice. And of course, most alcoholics that are new, they have a big, fat, dirty, rotten chip on their shoulder about God, usually. They don't trust any kind of higher power at all. It doesn't work for them. And it's all kind of characterized by this unmanageability that kind of sweeps over everything. We can't seem to accept life on life's terms. And here is one of the things that I told somebody recently. The truth of the matter is that once we put a drop of alcohol in our body, it is impossible for us to predict where we're gonna end up. There's no guarantees. I can tell you that I'm gonna be at your wedding. Nellie, I can tell you I'm gonna be there, and I put a drop of alcohol in my body and it's anybody's guess. We're unreliable. And this deep, debilitating fear for me, and I see it in others, this fear that we do not know who we are going to be without alcohol. This whole thing about identity and who we are. I was petrified to let go of my identity, no matter how cruddy an identity it was. I had absolutely no idea what I liked, what I didn't like, because alcohol wasn't there to tell me. I had no idea what I believed and didn't believe, what color I liked, if I wanted these dogs, if I didn't want them. I didn't know, do I like where I live? Do I like this furniture? What my politics were? What colors I liked? I had no idea. The thought of not drinking made panic seize my heart. How would I live in my own skin? How would I ever live in my own skin? What happens if I'm not the life of the party anymore, like I was, okay? My life was enmeshed, our lives become enmeshed with alcohol, and our identity becomes enmeshed. We are alcoholics, and we see everything through those glasses. And this, when somebody's getting ready to lose their identity, if you've ever, it's a pretty scary thing. You know, when anybody is losing their identity as a son or a daughter or a wife or a mother or a husband, those things are powerful. And we clutch and we grasp, and sometimes it keeps us stuck and it keeps us going back to things, maybe even abusive things, because the known is better than the unknown. And that's how it is for us. It's a huge act of faith for us to stop drinking. And it's kind of akin, I always think about it, about going through one door after another, after another, after another, and you do not know what's behind each of those doors. Is it going to be worse than, is it going to be better? Is it going to be worse? Is it going to be better? It's a big act of faith. And that is one of the reasons that getting sober is so hard. Not only do we have this bodily addiction, but we have the craziness in our head, and we have spiritual bankruptcy. It is like a three-legged stool, and it has to be tackled on all three fronts in order to for you to recover all three fronts at the same time. If you're missing one, your chances are pretty bad. So for the body, of course, we have to stop using and drinking, and this phenomenon of craving has to quit taking over our lives. And we have to kind of get past those first few days without alcohol and drugs. However, I don't believe that this is any more important. This bodily part is any more important than the other two. Some people go to treatment. I was not able to do that, but treatment is a wonderful thing. But if it was just treatment, then people would go away to treatment and come back and be well. And it doesn't happen like that all the time. Some people need, it's a good start, but it's not always going to work. Some people need medication. They need to see doctors. It's a very dangerous thing to try to get off drugs and alcohol, depending on how far along your disease is. And we encourage people to see doctors. We encourage them to do this the safe way. But it's not enough. For our mind, we absolutely have to have community around us. We have to have community. We have to have our friends. Whether that's in AA or NA or life groups, I found tremendous support in AA. Tremendous. From the day I walked in, they were there. I found tremendous support in my life group. They kind of carried me along. Everything working together all at the same time, moving me forward. You need people who will hold you accountable and will listen to you and not judge. And of course, we have to have education. We have to understand why this does the thing to our body it does and what our triggers are. I have learned my triggers, man. And they don't make a lot of sense to a lot of people, but I know what they are. And we have to learn what ours are. We need systematic steps to help us unravel the mess we have made of our lives. And fortunately, there's a lot of programs out there that do that, like Celebrate Recovery and NA and AA also. Many of us need therapy. I mean, we have really, really bad thought patterns, and we have been wounded and hurt, many of us, and we have distorted our identity from so many years of drinking. We need help, and some of us do need therapy. Our best thinking got us drunk, so we need to change that. Those grooves that we've kind of dug in our brain that every time we get in a situation, we move this way. We need help moving this way and digging new trenches. And we need to face our fears. Alcoholics are some of the most fearful people in the world. And many of them have really good reason to be fearful. Fear of the unknown kind of grips us and keeps us going back again and again, regardless. And for our spirit, here's the thing about the spiritual side of this. I said before that people that come into alcohol, come into recovery, they have this big, fat, dirty, rotten chip on their shoulder about God. And one of the first things that we have people do is to design their own God. And this is a very scary thing, especially for Christians. Like, they're always like, what do you mean you're designing your own God? They have to start somewhere. And so we say to them, you don't believe in God? Make up your God. Make it up. Whatever. And invariably, here's the kind of characteristics that this God that they make up has. He is kind and healing and forgiving and just and loving. I know that God. And so do you. And then they tell us that we have to start talking to that God and humble ourselves before that God and start trusting in him. And when they start doing this, man, the momentum starts building. And now they are ready to take some steps of recovery. And when we humble ourselves underneath the mighty hand of God, this amazing thing happens. It's like he's there. He meets us there. He scoops us up and he takes us with him. He has been waiting for us. So the steps of recovery, there's many different ones. I happen to subscribe to the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and but all of them have some common themes. And the first step always involves humility, acknowledgement of the addiction, and surrender to God. This unmanageability, this crying out, this raising the white flag. I will never forget when that happened to me. I was, knew Hyatt had transferred me here from the East Coast, and I was living right over here in the Heights. I tried another geographical change. And the first time I hit defeat, man, I was out at midnight one night on my front sidewalk, and I wanted to tear the bark off the trees. I wanted to drink so bad. And I fell on my knees and I said, oh God, please help me. Please help me. If I'd had a white flag, I would have raised it. And the next day I was walking my dog. I was pretty hungover. I was right outside in front of this church, and somebody said to me, come on in. Come in. And I said, what is this place? And they said, it's a church. And I said, no way. And they said, oh yeah, it is. And I said, I have my dog. And they said, well, bring him. And I was like, okay. And I sat in the back and cried for the first 6 months. And I was willing at that point to do anything, but God met me there. Now, I know that doesn't happen like that for everybody, but for me, for this alcoholic, that's how it happened. And I always think about that story of me sitting in the back of the church, me praying one night, and then me walking in here the next night. That's why I have such a soft spot in my heart for this place. And I sat right back where Stephen Huey is sitting right now, and bald. And And you know, the weird thing is that I'm only in here on communion Sundays, but when I'm in here, I'm always like at the back, and I'm watching for people. And so every once in a while, I'll see somebody sitting in the back, and they're crying. Or I don't recognize them, and I'm always like, honey, it's going to get better. It's going to get better. You know, and I know that maybe that this is their first time. Maybe they have come face to face with the God of the universe for the first time, and they have this emotional reaction like I did. And I always try to reach out to them. I also always wonder if they're here to take my job. because that's where Michael found me. I'm just kidding. I just had this argument with him last night about that I didn't do that kind of thing. I'm so sorry. Here's my favorite verse from James. I love this verse. It's James 4, 6 to 10. And it says, and what he gives in love is far better than anything else you'll find. It's common knowledge that God goes against the willful proud and gives grace to the willing humble. So let God do his work in you. Say a quiet yes to God, and he'll be there in no time. Quit dabbling. Purify your inner life. Quit playing the fill. Hit bottom and cry your eyes out. The fun and games are over. Get serious, really serious. Get down on your knees before the master. It's the only way to get back on your feet. We have this saying in AA that says, when I turned my life and my will over to the care of God, I took my life out of the hands of an idiot. And this is one of my favorite things to watch in recovery, is when somebody has opened the door a little bit for God, to God, and God just moves in, and all of a sudden, all these really cool things start to happen, right, Cassie? All these cool things, people who didn't even believe, and they made up this God, and then they start talking to him and humbling themselves, and then they start submitting to his will, and whoa, you ever want to see some really cool miracles happen? Go hang out with an alcoholic in recovery, because it is a wonderful, beautiful thing. And of course, we have all the rigorous honesty and dismantling of the old life, all of these great Christian traditions of confession and repentance and amends. We face our demons and we make things right, unless to do so would injure others. And before the end of this, we are standing upright. And we are in much, much better shape. And we reclaim our identity. We humbly proclaim victory. Victory has been available to us all the time. See, here's the thing. God wants us to be victorious over this. He does. And he has provided everything we need to be victorious. Everything that is not his desire, that I participate in my disease. It is not his desire. And he will give me whatever I need. And that can take the form of many different things. It could take the form that I will hear something a little bit different when I'm reading the Bible or when I'm praying. I will hear it a little bit differently. And all of a sudden, I have the strength not to do it. Or he will use another person. One day I was at CVS, and I was about to fill a prescription that I should not be filling. I had a toothache, didn't tell my dentist I was an addict and alcoholic, gave me Darvocet. Can't have it. I cannot have it. Because even though I'm not a drug addict, that kind of thing will take me back to my drug of choice like that. And but I was in pain, and I really wanted some help. And I was standing in line, and I was like, God, please help me. Ring, Megan Breed on the phone. What are you doing? Hey, Jill, what are you doing? I'm standing in line at CVS about to do something I'm not supposed to do. Really? Well, let's fix that. Let's work. Let's talk about it. Get up there. Are you at the front? I'm at the front of the line. Tell her right now where I can hear you. I'm not supposed to have that. And please put it in my file. Go ahead, Jill. Do it. That's the way that I get victory. Or I'll be suddenly able to play the tape all the way through to the end, which I usually can't do. Or suddenly the desire will go away. 1 Corinthians 15:51 says, but now in one victorious stroke of life, all three, sin, guilt, and death, are gone. The gift of our master. Thank God. With all this going for us, my dear, dear friends, stand your ground. Don't hold back. Throw yourself into the work of the master, confident that nothing you do is a waste of time or effort. Or 2 Corinthians 2:14, now thanks be to God who always causes us to triumph. As we reclaim our identity, for me, that was a huge, huge thing because I'd had a lot of labels put on me as a child. And I will never forget when that journey began for me of reclaiming my identity. My younger brother was staying with me for a little while, and I had been crying to him, I don't know who I am anymore. What's these dogs? What am I doing? And I was out back planting flowers, and he came out back on the back porch, and I can see him now, and he said, this is my sister Jill. She likes to plant flowers. And I was like, yes, I do. I certainly do. I like to plant flowers. Yes, the one thing. And as I did the things that people told me to do, I found that God started putting my identity back together again. I found out that that I like children and that I'm kind of creative. And I like to bring order to chaos, and I really love to make chaos. I found out, Michael's like, yes. I found out that I love the color orange. I found out what I believe politically. I found out what kind of people I like to hang out with. Okay, right over here. I found all this out because until you own that identity and until you walk in it, you will not have any security or authority. The door is flung wide open, and all we have to do is walk through it. And another, and another, and everyone gets easier and easier. And of course, there's the lather, rinse, repeat, what I call it, all those maintenance steps that, you know, we have to do. Many of you have to do them. They're great traditions in the Christian life of scripture and prayer and meditation. But for us, me and my friends, our life depends on it. We have to stay connected to God. We are kept on a pretty tight leash. Now, I know some people say that they were healed and that boom, boom, and that was over with. Okay. I have to walk, for me and my friends, we have to walk through it like everybody else has for years and years and years. I think it's because, and I just heard this the other night at a meeting, I think it's because God keeps us on a really short leash. We are like that dog in Up. You know the dog? You know, where we're like sitting and talking and we're doing our own thing and we're doing all of a sudden, we're like, squirrel! And that is totally like us. And God has to keep my attention all the time, or I will stray. So for me, I have to put these principles. Okay. And before you know it, we have found that we intuitively know how to handle things that used to baffle us. We lose our fear of people and financial insecurity. We won't regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will experience peace and we'll lose selfish interest. And somewhere in this whole thing, this desire to drink and use leaves us. Well, that is a beautiful thing, my friends. And we suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. So here's what I'd like for you to do. I would like for you guys to be really brave, and I'd like you guys to take that person that's on your insert that you wrote down, and I would like you to pray for them every single day this week that God will move in their life, that God will bring them to a place where they cry out. And then we'll come back here next week when I talk to families of alcoholics and we'll see what kind of cool things God did. I don't care if you have to put it on your dashboard, your mirror, you know, whatever, your closet, your computer, but put it somewhere so that you can pray for them. If you will do that, please raise your hand. Thank you very much. All right. Well, and we'd like a chance to pray for you this morning, too. We'd like a chance to pray for you if you'd like to open the door about this much. That's completely cool, okay? Or if you have a family member that you'd really like to pray for, that's completely cool. We'd love to do that. Or if you have anything that is hurting, wounded, and that needs help, we would love to pray for you. So I'd like the prayer team to come forward. Come on. Time's a-wasting. Lunch is waiting. Come on. And even if you're struggling to stay sober, man, even if you've got some sobriety but you're just struggling, please let us pray for you. And I'm going to bless you, and then you're free to leave, or you are free to come up and get prayer. So why don't we all stand up? I bless you in the name of our Lord Jesus, who knows you inside and out, who knows who you really are, and loves you. The Lord go with you. Amen. Come up and get prayer if you need it.